morning. Ask you to open the Bible this morning, book of Daniel, chapter 5. Daniel, chapter 5 in your Bible this morning. We're going to read that story and talk about it in the few minutes that we have together today. Good to see you this morning. To our visitors who are with us, thank you for worshiping God with us today and the privilege of your presence. And we do hope that if it's your first time, it won't be your last time, that you'll talk to us about any questions you have or anything you're wondering about biblically. We'd love to know what brought you our way and how we can help you in your search for relationship with God. But we're glad that you are here with us this morning. Book of Daniel as a whole, we often use as at least the first several chapters as stories that are often taught in our kids' Bible classes. A lot of the stories that we teach in kids' Bible classes, we kind of never really come back to as a Do we ever think about that? How many of those great old stories from Genesis or Exodus or Joshua or some of the great stories in Samuel and Kings? We don't think about them from the adult perspective very often. We don't have them in our Bible classes as much. We certainly don't preach on them as much. And yet these stories, while certainly they're great for capturing our children's imagination, showing them how great God is, all the kinds of things that he is capable of. There's certainly depths to these stories that are worth thinking about as adults as well. The book of Daniel as a whole, for all the ways that we use it in our young people. You know, Daniel chapter 1, when Daniel refuses the king's food bravely, you know, and we use that in our kids to teach them about the courage of standing up for what's right. Or Daniel chapter 3, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace. Remember that story. And again, the courage to stand for your convictions and stand for God no matter what. Or everybody remembers Daniel chapter 6 when Daniel's thrown to the lions. Remember that story? Yeah. The book of Daniel's full of great stories, including this one in chapter 5. And these stories, really, we need them as much as adults, I think, as we need our kids to hear them early on and learn the importance about standing for God no matter what. Because it's challenging as adults to stand for God no matter what in the world, isn't it? In fact, sometimes the stakes get a little bit higher because when we're younger, it's just maybe a little bullying from our peers or feeling awkward or embarrassed because we won't do what everybody else does. But when you get to be an adult and you live the way you're supposed to in the world, that can have some heavier consequences, can it? When you refuse to play the game in the office and injure your career as a result because you won't compromise morally the way everyone else compromises themselves to get ahead or keep the boss happy or keep the customer pleased or whatever it is. And the same thing as we get older, even in our educations where maybe perhaps young people, we won't give the answer the teacher wants because we know it's not true in class. And that sometimes puts a bullseye on our back. The challenge to be a person of God in a decadent, pagan, and dying culture is the same 2,500 years ago as it is today. And so these are stories that really are worth reading again as adults about how to be the people of God living in a world that can be actively hostile to the things of God. I mean, what's Daniel chapter 1 really about with Daniel and the king's food? What it's really about is the attempt of the world to force you into their culture. That's what they were really wanting out of Daniel and his three friends who were also being pushed to eat the king's food. They wanted them to embrace Babylonian culture. They wanted to make them worship their culture's goods and gods. That's what they wanted. And they wanted them to, especially like in Daniel chapter 3 then, where you had to bow down to our idols as well. They wanted you to worship what they worship rather than serving the one true God. And what you see ultimately, and another story that sometimes we teach our children about in Daniel chapter 4, when Nebuchadnezzar in his pride is bragging upon all he's accomplished. Remember what happens in that chapter, in that story? God humbles him and turns him into a beast for a while, or at least takes away his mind so that he acts like a beast, a mere animal for a while, and so that he can learn that man, when man rejects God, is literally no better, no different than just a beast of the field. And so God in some ways in these stories judges the arrogance implicit in the culture and explicit in many of the culture's leaders. That's still a world we live in. We know that. We understand that. And so when we come to Daniel chapter 5, we have a great turning moment in the book. Daniel chapter 5 is literally the last night of the Babylonian Empire. These stories that we've been talking about with Daniel, except for chapter 6 in the lion's den, all of these stories happen while the Jews are captives of the Babylonian Empire. And literally in Daniel chapter 5, you have the empire's last night. It's the story of the fall of that empire. It has pushed and it has pressed Daniel and his friends to become like them. They have courageously resisted at the risk of their lives, no less, to maintain God's ways in the midst of a pagan and broken world. And God has finally come to the point where he will judge the arrogance of the world, and especially its harassment of the people of God. There is a legitimate sense in which you can almost read Daniel chapter 5 as a in this life dress rehearsal for what the day of judgment is. When God finally, when the moment comes when God finally judges the world for its wickedness and its arrogance and for its oppression and its harassment of his people. Have your Bible, Daniel chapter 5. I want to read through this story and again, maybe try to refamiliarize ourselves with it, reconnect with it if you haven't read this story in a long time. And so Daniel chapter 1, beginning of verse 1, Belshazzar the king held a great feast for 1,000 of his nobles, and he was drinking wine in the presence of the 1,000. When Belshazzar tasted the wine, he gave orders to bring the gold and the silver vessels, which Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, so the kings and his nobles, his wives, his concubines might drink from them. And so they brought the gold vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God, which was in Jerusalem. And the king and his nobles, wives, concubines drank from them. They drank the wine and they praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Catch that for a moment. They take God's things that they had captured once upon a time, and they use them idolatrously to worship their gods. They take God's things to worship their gods. The arrogance goes on. And suddenly, here they are carrying on, and suddenly the fingers of a man's hand emerged and began writing opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the back of the hand that did the writing. And the king's face grew pale, and his thoughts alarmed him, and his hip joints went slack, and his knees began knocking together. And all of a sudden, the party's not so fun anymore. Belshazzar is drinking wine and throwing a party and worshiping his gods and using God's things to do it. He's repurposed God's special temple items to praise his own gods. He thinks because he's captured Jerusalem, or at least his empire has once upon a time several decades before, that that means they're better than the God who dwelt in that city, whose temple they destroyed. And so they take holy things and they blaspheme from them. And suddenly, I love that word, suddenly, we go from drunken party to abject terror. And Scripture wants us to understand just how terrifying that moment was when a hand, just a hand, appears and writes on the wall, and his face is pale. You ever seen someone who's not just been startled, not just like, you know, you come around the corner and you didn't know somebody was there, and oh. You ever seen somebody who's been really startled, somebody who's really been shaken, the blood drains from their face? You ever seen somebody? It doesn't happen very often that somebody is that rattled. This is that rare moment. His face is pale. His thoughts alarmed him, which has got to be one of Scripture's greatest understatements. And his hip joints went slack and his knees began knocking together. You ever had something really, really startle and stun you? Not oh, you come around the corner and somebody surprises you. I'm talking about some sort of unexpected news that you just find out. The phone rings, you pick it up, and it's the worst possible news. You ever feel your legs go weak? You ever feel your whole body become numb? That's Belshazzar in this moment. He's terrified. From drunken party to abject terror, just like that. And so we have a moment in which reality comes to reckon with a great and arrogant power. Understand how arrogant this moment was on the part of Belshazzar. I want you to understand something. The Persians who will conquer the Babylonian Empire, this is the Babylonian Empire's last night. The Persian army who will conquer the city is already outside the walls. They didn't move in. There wasn't a surprise attack as such. It's just that the walls of Babylon were so great, their gates so powerful, the city so well supplied, that literally Belshazzar and his people think they can just sit inside the city and wait it out. We'll wait the siege out. We have everything we need. They can't breach the wall. They can't get through the gates. Our army is strong enough to hold this line. And so perhaps maybe almost as a way of maintaining morale in a difficult moment, Belshazzar throws a party. And it's fascinating. He's not scared of the Persians. He's not taking the Persians seriously until this moment happens and he realizes we are in far greater trouble than we realized. And so we read on. Verse 10. And the king entered the banquet hall because of the words of the kings and the nobles. And somebody's, by the way, sitting there and saying, well, I thought all his wives and concubines were drinking with him at the party. Yeah, that's right. The queen here probably means better the queen mother, i.e. his mother or grandmother. Somebody of age and wisdom who's been around a while to help a younger person and a younger generation understand what's going on. And the queen comes into the banquet hall now because of the words of the kings and the nobles. And the queen spoke, picking up in verse 10. O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts alarm you or your face be pale. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. And in the days of your father, illumination, insight, and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father, the king, appointed him chief of magicians, conjurers, and Chaldeans, and diviners. This was because an extraordinary spirit of knowledge and insight, interpretation of dreams, explanation of enigmas, and solving of difficult problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Let Daniel now be summoned, and he will declare the interpretation. Let's stop right there for just a moment. So what's going on here? Up to this point, if you read verses 8 and 9 in between verses 6 and 7 where we stopped and verse 10 where we just picked up, Belshazzar calls in all his wise men, and they have no answers. They can't explain what this hand is about, who sent it, or what the writing on the wall means. It's not that they couldn't understand the words. The words were from languages they knew, but what's the point of writing these words in this moment? We'll come back to that, but just understand that it wasn't that there was some foreign, weird language. That's not what was going on at all. They just couldn't understand what do these words mean right here, right now, in this context. And so the wisest and the elite that called in all the experts, they had a committee, they had a panel, and nobody of Belshazzar's world could answer that. But then the old lady, the queen, comes in, and she says, there's another old guy whom your father used to take seriously, but apparently you don't know who he is anymore. That seems to be the implication. Daniel. He's the guy who always knows what's going on. He's the guy who's in connection with the divine for real. And that's the guy you need right now. And so Belshazzar was brought before the king. And the king spoke to Daniel and said, are you that Daniel? See, Belshazzar has no idea who this guy is anymore. That's a sign of how far it's decayed. At least Nebuchadnezzar in all his arrogance could recognize excellence when he saw it. Belshazzar is so decadent, he doesn't even know a great man when he sees him anymore. And so Daniel, who at this point has got to be an older man, at this point, if you just think about the timeline in the book, are you that Daniel, Belshazzar asks, who is one of the exiles from Judah, whom my father, the king, brought from Judah? Now, I have heard about you. There's a spirit of the gods in you, and that illumination, insight, and extraordinary wisdom have been found in you. But since I don't run in those circles, I wouldn't know. Put that in parentheses. I'm not that kind of guy. I'm a party guy. I'm a fun guy. I'm not serious about running my kingdom greatly. By the way, that's why we're in the predicament we're in. Anyways, just now the wise men and the conjurers who were brought before me, that they might read this inscription and make its interpretation known to me, they couldn't declare the interpretation of the message, but I personally have heard about you, that you are able to give interpretations and solve difficult problems. So if you are able to read the inscription and make its interpretation known to me, you will be clothed with purple and wear a necklace of gold around your neck, and you will have authority as third ruler in the kingdom. And it's interesting. It's interesting that the only thing that Belshazzar can offer Daniel in this moment are the things that he thinks matter. You ever thought about that? He doesn't offer him the opportunity to say, if you're still in exile, maybe go home. I mean, then he makes sure Daniel is reminded, you're in exile. He doesn't offer me thinking that Daniel might wonder, might be valuable to Daniel. Daniel, if the spirit of the gods is in him and he's a solver of mysteries and has extraordinary wisdom, maybe Daniel values things a little bit differently. Maybe there's something Daniel could teach Belshazzar about what matters in life. But all Belshazzar, typical of the embodiment of his culture, his regime, all he can do is offer Daniel the things he thinks matter: wealth and power. And so what goes on next? What goes on next is this, if we keep on reading. Verse 17. Daniel answered and said before the king, "Keep your gifts for yourself or give your rewards to somebody else." Ouch. It doesn't matter to me, king. "However, I will read the inscription to the king and make the interpretation known to him. O king, the Most High God granted sovereignty, grandeur, glory, and majesty to Nebuchadnezzar, your father. And because of the grandeur which he bestowed on him and all the people, nations, men of every language, feared and trembled before him. Whomever he wished killed, he killed. And whomever he wished spared alive, he spared. And whoever he wished delivered, he delivered. Verse 20, "But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit became so proud that he behaved arrogantly, he was deposed from his royal throne and his glory was taken away from him. And he was driven away from mankind and said it, and his heart was made like that of beasts, and his dwelling place was that of wild donkeys. He was given grass to eat like cattle, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until he recognized that the Most High God is ruler over the realm of mankind. He sets over to whomever he wishes. Yet you, his son Belshazzar," listen now, verse 22, "you, his son, have not humbled your heart, even though," look at what comes next, "you knew all this." I'm sure it was an embarrassing family story. I'm sure they didn't talk about it every Thanksgiving or birthday get together. But nobody in the family forgot that day, that season, when Nebuchadnezzar lost his mind. And everybody would have known, because Daniel was involved in that story too, what it meant that the true God of heaven can't stand the arrogance of men. And yet here we are in Daniel chapter 5. Nebuchadnezzar is now passed from the scene. One of his heirs, Belshazzar, is on the throne. Belshazzar knows this story and knows the significance of it. And yet Belshazzar is still partying. Belshazzar is still taking God's things and using them to worship his gods. Belshazzar has chosen not to learn the lesson that Nebuchadnezzar's life made clear. And so Daniel makes explicitly clear to Belshazzar, "I don't want the things that are important in your world. They don't matter to me." And not only that, but you have not learned the lesson of your grandfather. You have now making the same mistake that he made. You knew all this, but instead you've exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven, and they have brought the vessels of God's house before you, and you, your nobles, your wives, and concubines have been drinking wine from them, and you have praised the gods of silver, gold, bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see or hear or understand, but the God in whose hand are your life breath and your ways, you have not glorified. And so then this hand was sent from him, and this inscription was written. Now, you want to know who sent this? The God whom you've insulted, the God whom you've blasphemed, the God who you have ignored while you worship things of gold and silver and bronze. And that's why all Belshazzar can do is pass that stuff out, by the way, because that's all he knows of the world: money and power. Nothing more to life than that. You took the holy things of God and made them profane. You have set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. You have used your life to pursue godless things while ignoring the God who holds your life in his hand. And folks, that same God holds each of our lives in his hand to this day as well. There's nothing special. He only does that with kings or something like that. That's each and every person. And each and every person stands before God. And God looks at our lives. And God looks for those who recognize him and live in dependence upon him and humility because we live in dependence upon him. And those who think we are the captains of our fate. We determine the fates of our souls. And so the hand was sent and the words were written. And this was the inscription: "Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin." And this is the interpretation of the message. The words aren't hard. The words were from languages they knew. There were weird words to us, but they were languages that were easily and well known in that world. It's just like maybe to us today, writing several words from our dictionary on the wall, but you need context. You need to know what cat and hat and mat have to do with each other in this context. Why tonight? Why this day? Why now are these words mysteriously written on the wall? That's what they were facing. But Daniel knows what these words mean. Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and put it to an end, because that word literally meant to be numbered or counted. And it's repeated twice. The idea is that God has thoroughly examined you. He's taken complete stock of you. He has looked through this empire and this kingdom and this king from head to tail, from end to end. He has thoroughly numbered it. It's a way of saying he's taken inventory of what's going on here, of what you are. For several decades, he's watched how you've treated his people. Even though he gave them into your hand, you weren't supposed to treat them the way you have. For several decades, he's watched how you have used the power that he has given you in history and the world, and you didn't fall down and fear the one true God of heaven. Instead, it went to your head, and you just became prouder and prouder. He has numbered you, mene, mene. He has thoroughly taken inventory of who and what you are. Tekel, that's the next one. That's the next one. He puts them on the scale, and he weighs them. Tekel, that word actually is related to the word that you know from the Bible more commonly, shekel. It's actually the same basic Semitic root. And the idea of a shekel, we usually hear the word shekel, you think of money, but it was a certain amount of silver that was in the coin that made it a shekel. It was a certain amount of weight. And so it actually was a term of weighing. And again, it was a way of putting it on a scale and weighing it. Now think about that. Usually today we get on the digital scale and it just tells us what we weigh or how much meat we're buying at the deli or whatever it is. In the ancient world, though, they didn't have semiconductors. So what did they do? The way they weighed things was they would put them on a scale. And on one balance or one side of the balance, everybody knows this, but think about this for a moment. On one side of the balance, you put the item that you're weighing, that you're evaluating. You want to know how much of it is there, how much substance is in this item. And on the other side, you'd put a known weight. You'd put a shekel or some other weight there. And then you'd see the item that you're weighing. Is it more or is it less than the shekel? Because the idea is if I'm trying to trade with somebody, right, I want a shekel's value for whatever it is. That makes sense. But basically what it means is not only are we numbering things first, mene, mene, we're taking thorough inventory. What he's also doing is he's weighing them. He's evaluating them according to a standard. How do these people weigh versus what I consider to be a worthy human life and a righteous nation? I will weigh them against a standard and I will see how they measure up. And you know what he says? You have been weighed and found deficient. There's no substance to you. You may have great power in this life and great wealth, but there's nothing there. There's nothing to it. You have been weighed. You've been measured against an objective standard, just like in the ancient world when you weigh something on a scale against a known weight. And there's nothing to you. You are deficient. Oh, do we need to remember that, ladies and gentlemen, that when God looks at the world and looks at that which claims it is something, it's often nothing. That what we are often encouraged and tempted by the world to value and pursue and think important. Listen, the young people, listen to this morning. When God's eyes, when it is actually weighed against his standards and his values, often most of what makes up this world and this life simply does not measure up. It is deficient. There is no substance or reality to it. Here's Belshazzar offering Daniel the gold, the wealth, and third ruler in the kingdom. And the reason Daniel can say, keep it, king, I'll tell you the interpretation anyways, but I don't want that stuff, is because Daniel knows Tekel. He understands that there's nothing to this in reality in God's eyes. How little is there to it? Because all you get to do when you're third ruler of the kingdom is keep that job description for about 3 more hours that night when the Persians overrun the city and surprise the Babylonians. This is a question for you and I this morning, ladies and gentlemen. Is if God were to look at our life and check us about how we're spending our time, where the allegiance of our heart is, what we value and order our lives around, the level of pride versus the level of humility that's truly in our hearts, how would we weigh before him? And then thirdly, upharsin, which is a form of paris, which literally, again, is just a verb for dividing, but probably chosen by God intentionally because in their languages it also sounds like how you pronounce the word Persian, who were the people outside the gate that very moment. I've taken thorough inventory of you. I've weighed you against my divine standards. And you are to be divided out. You are to be dismembered. You are to be handed over to the Persians. The kingdom is divided and it's given away. That foreign army was outside the city that very moment, but the Babylonians weren't taking it that serious. They did not think they would breach their walls. They did not think they would break their gates. They did not think their military might would fail them in this moment. Yes, they were under siege, but they were in an impenetrable, well-supplied fortress. How often do we know that we're in danger? How often do we choose to take the most optimistic possibility, no matter how unlikely it is, and focus on that rather than on reality? How often do we ignore the warning signs? Like an enemy army outside the gate, we think our walls will hold, our gates will happen. We will never be held accountable. The party will never stop. Our luck will never run out. The odds will never fail us. How often, how many sermons are the stuff we already know, but if we're honest with ourselves, it's the stuff we aren't doing? I remember years ago listening to one fellow talk about how, a preacher talk about how his dream was to preach the same sermon over and over again. When the folks in the congregation finally got tired of it and asked him why he keeps doing that, he said, well, when you start doing what I'm preaching, then we'll move on to something else. I'm not that brave. Well, let's be honest. How often, Sunday after Sunday, do we hear things we know and know we're not going to change it? What happens when you ignore the warning signs? What happens when you play a sport or you exercise and some joint pain begins? It starts small and you ignore it and you keep going until damage is done and you have no cartilage left, right? How often do we want to keep playing. We really believe it won't happen to us. We won't get seriously injured. It won't, the laws of reality won't catch up with us. And so often, folks, we tend to be more vulnerable to temptation when we are too busy to pay attention to the things that matter. Like Belshazzar that night. Think about our own daily life. When we're spread too thin, when we're too busy, when we're tired and when we're stressed, that's when we're more vulnerable to sin and certain temptations. That's when we lose the willpower to resist. That's where we lose the strength to say no and endure the consequences. When we're tired, when we're worn down. And so God takes inventory. He weighs how they're living, and it's worthless. There's nothing to it in reality. And he gives them over to the Medes and the Persians. And staggeringly, what happens next in the story, verse 29, is that Belshazzar gave orders anyways, and they clothed Daniel with purple. They put a necklace of gold around his neck and issued a proclamation concerning him that he now had authority as the third ruler in the kingdom for just a few more hours. Because verse 30, that same night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. There's a lot that goes on in that word suddenly back up early in the chapter, isn't there? The night begins with an idolatrous orgy. A few words are written on a wall, and within hours, the king is dead. And the gold and the purple robe. And being third ruler in the kingdom doesn't matter, just like Daniel knew all along. How quickly this life can end. And it's not just because there could be a car wreck this afternoon. It's not just because there could be a cancer diagnosis this week. It could end very quickly because Jesus could come back suddenly any moment. And then what? And then what? What does the handwriting on the wall mean for us? A phrase that no less has even become a cliche in our culture, isn't it? Don't we sometimes talk about somebody who can't see the handwriting on the wall? What do we mean when we say that? We mean somebody who sees what's going on and doesn't get what it means. That's what we mean, right? Just like Belshazzar, he could see the words on the wall, but he was so lost, so decadent, he could not begin to imagine what those words might mean, even though there was an enemy army right outside his gate. So distracted, so debauched, so debased. Well, what does it mean for us? How do we read the handwriting on the wall about God, about this world, about our own lives? Two quick observations. Get the right purpose in life. Here's Belshazzar thinking all that matters is money and power, and Daniel will tell me what it means for the money and power. If he's any good, that's what I'll give him. Daniel doesn't want that stuff. Belshazzar gives Daniel the most valuable things in his world as he lives. And then just a little bit later, he's killed. Such a stark juxtaposition, don't you think? The inspired storyteller who writes these words wants us to see it that way. That's why you write verse 29 the way you write it, and then you write right next to it verse 30, because we're meant to see a stark juxtaposition. We're supposed to get a little bit of a whiplash from Daniel getting into stuff that so many people, including us too often, want out of life, with the imminence of death that makes it all meaningless and worthless. In light of death, in light of the fall of that city and that world as they knew it, what girl or good is a purple jacket, a gold chain, and authority from somebody who's not going to be boss in a few hours? And yet so often we still pursue the world's values. Young people, I want you to think very carefully about the world and what it teaches you to want and to desire. It's kind of funny, even just pop culture, those of us who've lived a little bit longer know how this works. It's interesting how what's so cool and so desirable and so pressing right now, people will pay good money for certain experiences and certain cars and certain brands and certain clothes. And 20 years from now, they'll be in a thrift shop. And the songs will be the answer to a trivia question. And the movie and the Oscar winner will be forgotten because some new thing will have come along. And if you try to wear that expensive brand now, you'll be laughed at when it's 20 years out of date. That car that you wanted so badly and you paid so much for, people will be saying, that's an old car. You need to get a new one. It's so trivial and it's so fleeting. Just a few years and it's all gone. Pull out your parents' yearbook, young people, and look at their clothes and their styles. Look at how they did their hair. Look at the songs and TV shows they watched. And it's okay to laugh a little. And just remember, your kids are going to do the same to you right now. Don't value what the world values. Don't think it's important. And above all, please don't kid yourself that it lasts, because it does not. Get the right purpose. Here's Belshazzar literally drinking the final hours of his life away. We waste so much time, even when we're busy, because we're busy with the wrong things. And so I think about Psalm 39, beginning in verse 4. Where the psalmist wisely says, Lord, make me to know my end and what is the extent of my days. Let me know how transient I am. Behold, you have made my days as handbreadths. My life can just fit in the palm of God's hand. My lifetime is as nothing in your sight. Surely every man at his best is a mere breath. Surely every man walks about as a phantom. Surely, therefore, they make an uproar for nothing and amass riches and do not know who will gather them. You see how the psalmist jumps from, my life is short and fragile. Therefore, how most of us live is utterly foolish. If I realize how short life is, then they make an uproar for nothing. We are so anxious and agitated. We are so covetous and so obsessed. And for what? In the psalmist's words, it's an uproar for nothing. See the handwriting on the wall about your own life, and get the right purpose. And number two, get the right priorities. get the right priorities. All Belshazzar could see was his kingdom and its endurance. He really didn't think he'd fall that night. He didn't think the Persians would get in. He thought the walls would hold, and nothing could lead to his downfall. The problem was he trusted in his own kingdom rather than God's. And it was a kingdom battle even then. We hear that language of kingdom, and we think New Testament. We think about Jesus, my kingdom is not of this world, and language like that. And that's all well and good. But in the book of Daniel, it's very much about two kingdoms. Because in the book of Daniel in chapter 4, the story that Daniel reminded Belshazzar, you know this. You know what God did to Nebuchadnezzar. You know how he humbled him. Back in that story, God's message then to Nebuchadnezzar was, God rules over the kingdoms of men and gives them to whomever he pleases. So if you're not focusing on God's kingdom and its righteousness first, then you've got the right wrong priority. Jesus did indeed preach the kingdom and bring to light the kingdom in a way that had not been known and seen before. And as Jesus makes clear, my kingdom is not of this world. It's of a different era, literally. And therefore has different values and different priorities. You need to seek first the kingdom and its righteousness. And then all these things that you worry about and you're desirous of, they'll be added to you. That doesn't literally mean you put God first and you'll get all this world stuff. What it means is the holes in our hearts and our lives that we're trying to fill with the power and the wealth and the promiscuous relationships and everything else that we pursue in this life. The needs and the desires that we are trying to meet with these things, that will be taken care of when you pursue God and God's priorities. If the most important things get the first and the best attention, then everything else in life that really matters gets taken care of. Do you believe that this morning? Does that affect how you live? Do you really believe that if you seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, all these things will be added to you? I think about what the psalmist says in Psalm 90, beginning in verse 10. Again, he starts from a place of recognizing how fleeting our life is. Suddenly, he dies that very night. And that could be any of us for any reason, any given day. Don't ever forget that. And so the psalmist in Psalm 90, beginning in verse 10, he said this. He said, as for the days of our life, they contain 70, or if due to strength, 80 years. Even if cancer and car wrecks don't get you, guess what? You're still on the clock. And you only got 70 or 80 years. And yet their pride is but labor and sorrow, and soon it is gone, and we fly away. Who understands the power of your anger and your fury according to the fear that is due you? So teach us to number our days, that we may present to you a heart of wisdom. And if you'll do that, and if you find that after you do what's most important first, then the things that you now don't have time or energy for didn't really matter in the eternal perspective anyways. You didn't get the promotion. You didn't get the job. Let me ask you something. In eternity, what's it going to change? You didn't get the pay raise. The investments didn't work out. You lose your business. You lose it all. In the grand scheme of eternity, what's it really going to matter? If you serve God, worship him with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, love others above yourself, whatever else we don't get to in life, really doesn't matter. And there will come a day, if you don't see it now, there will come a day when you'll see that handwriting on the wall. And you'll know what it meant, and you'll wish you had listened. Whenever you go to take a trip somewhere, I do this, you do this, we always put the most important things first, right? When you're trying to load a family of six into a minivan, it's like a real life game of Tetris. But when I load the minivan before we take a trip somewhere, I always start with the most important. The suitcases with the clothes. And the biggest suitcases first on the bottom, right, gentlemen? And we get the suitcases in. And then we start putting some of the kids' extra bags of other stuff they want to bring in. And what always happens when you're loading a family of six into a minivan, there's more sitting on the curb than there's room in the van. And so what do? First things first. And what do we tell our kids? You really don't need to take this with you. This can stay home. It doesn't matter for this trip. It's just 3 days. It's just 6 days. It's just 10 days. You don't have to take everything with you right now. We'll be back. You don't have to take it all. When we pack the car for the trip, we start with the most important things first. That way, the most important things go. And the things that don't matter are left behind. We get that when we travel within this life. Why don't we understand that as we're traveling out of this life? God help us to see the handwriting on the wall. He's God. He runs the world according to his purposes. And in the end, the world passes away. The kingdom always falls and the world ends in the end. And at most, you and I get 70 or 80 years in it. And then our chapter is done. Our part in the play is complete. And you can't take the purple robe and the gold chain and the job title with you. It's all about what's the purpose and what's the priority. God help us to keep focused on that. Lest what we often think of as a kid's story becomes a tragic adult story, our own. We're going to sing a song now, and this song is the opportunity for anybody who's here this morning who needs to get their purpose and priorities sorted out to let the congregation help you in some way with that. If maybe the way your purpose and priorities need to get sorted out this morning is by obeying the gospel of Jesus Christ, by actually becoming a citizen of Jesus' kingdom, we'll help you with that. As we sing this song, if you want to come forward and confess with your mouth at the end of that song that you believe Jesus is the Son of God, as you repent of your sins, we'll baptize you for those sins' forgiveness, and we'd love to do that this morning. Maybe you're here this morning, you're a child of God already, and you just need to get some things sorted out. Maybe there's some things on your life that should serve as a handwriting, a warning for you right now. But you need to get your purpose and priorities back on track. We'll be happy to help you, encourage you, in whatever way we can. If you need to get your life right with God, and we can be of any service, why don't you tell us while we stand, while we sing.